You are tuned to WPKN's Resistance Roundtable, which comes to you the second Saturday of each month from 10 to 11 a.m. In this hour, we'll talk about some of the breaking developments around the Trump debacle. We are joined by our regular panel, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Scott Harris, and myself, Richard Hill. Ruth Ann teaches English at Central Connecticut State University and is active in the American Association of University Professors there and nationally. Scott Harris is the host of Counterpoint Radio, which is a public affairs show that airs every Monday at 8 p.m. He is also the executive producer of Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, which is a nationally syndicated show that also airs here on WPKN. And I host First Tuesday Rainy Day Radio, the organic farm stand, and I'm one of the hosts that appears on the public issues show Mic Check, which airs every Sunday at 5:30 p.m. on WPKN. And this week we'll have two guests on the phone to discuss critical issues that our country and the world are confronting. First will be Edmund Garib, professional lecturer in law at George Washington University, who will discuss Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. troops and the resulting Turkish bombardment and incursion into that region. Then at 10:30, we'll be joined by John Nichols, national political correspondent for The Nation magazine, and also by Lisa Gilbert, who is vice president of legislative affairs for the public interest group Public Citizen. John and Lisa will talk about the Trump impeachment inquiry and the burgeoning scandal around the efforts to strong-arm the president of Ukraine into digging up dirt on Joe and Hunter Biden. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that are happening leading up in this past week. This is kind of a blow-your-ears-back week, as usual. Ruth, you've been keeping track of some of these things, so what's got your ears pinned to the sides of your head?
Well, this is called Ruth Ann's Long List, and it was developed because of our conversation the other night about where we should focus the show. This is the list of what goes on while candidate polls, impeachment, and sudden explosions of war occupy most of the media coverage. So I'm just going to read my list because our time is limited, and each of these could lead to a huge discussion. There's sporadic attention to gun control, climate change, and women's rights. It's usually accompanies huge public demonstrations on these subjects, and then it kind of goes away in between. Other issues that are happening quietly while we pay attention to other things are voter suppression efforts at the state level, most recently in Alabama, the Republican Party's decision to forego presidential primaries in at least four states, guaranteeing that Trump will be the only Republican candidate, negligence regarding election security, especially cybersecurity, a general abandonment or betrayal of international treaties and alliances, the government's wars on the press and generally the Constitution, instability in government offices, including last night's resignation of the acting Homeland Security chief. Acting heads may or may not be qualified, have not been vetted by Congress, and can be terminated or replaced by presidential whim. Appointment to cabinet and federal agency chairs of people specifically hostile to their purposes. Most recently, Eugene Scalia, son of Antonin Scalia, as Secretary of Labor. He's a lawyer with a national reputation for promoting corporate rights. He will now be in charge of enforcing laws meant to protect workers from unsafe working places, wage theft and overtime violations, and protecting labor unions. And Rick Perry to head the Energy Department during the 2016 campaign. You'll remember he promised to eliminate the Energy Department. There's a general civil service instability and thinning from ambassadors to scientists to accountants to enforcement agencies. The government assaults on freedom of the press, public education, and science. Large plans and small but effective actions designed to cripple or gut Medicare and eventually Social Security. Vital infrastructure improvement and maintenance has been deferred or neglected. Evidence that that's important is the fire currently burning in Southern California, which has been attributed tentatively to the electric grid. Children and adults still in cages along the border with Mexico. ICE raids in general are immigration policies, which are accompanied by the ongoing ginning up of anti-immigration sentiment. the ongoing efforts to privatize K through 12 education and politicize and corporatize higher education, the continuing expansion of private prisons and their uses rather than carrying out crucial criminal justice reforms, the looting of public funds and treasures through self-dealing and giveaways or bargain basement sales of public lands and public aquifers, the sacrifice of the planet to greed and ignorance from the bee to the bear, and raping of the land, sea, and air through cancellation of environmental protections, and the steadily increasing coarsening and brutalizing of public discourse beginning in the mouth of the president in his never-ending rallies. I'm sorry for the verbal stumbles, but I'm trying to go fast and resist expanding on these topics. Anyway, all of this is happening while we, for legitimate reasons, pay attention to big things, but don't forget the small things.
Absolutely. Have to keep our eye on that, on those many balls in the air. But I believe we are ready with our first guest. Scott?
Yes, we're very fortunate to have with us this morning Edmund Gharib. Edmund Gharib is an internationally recognized scholar on the Kurds and on Iraq. He teaches at American University. His books include The Kurdish Nationalist Movement, The Kurdish Question in Iraq, and War in the Gulf, which he co-authored with Majid Kuduri. Edmund Gharib, thank you so much for joining us here on Resistance Roundtable this morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, these are some horrendous times for the Kurds, and I wonder, as you have followed this incursion by Turkey, it's the fourth day of this military operation. Could you bring our listeners up to speed as to actually what is happening on the ground there in northern Syria? We've had reports of civilian casualties, bombings. In fact, Turkish artillery apparently targeted some U.S. forces early on in this operation.
What we have seen and heard so far is that the Turks have made the decision to invade that part of Syria, and they have attacked a number of areas, but close to the cities, such as near Qamishli, but and there have been also some attacks on some of these cities, and in the area of Ain Issa and a number of other areas on that border strip between the two countries. One of the there have been two main results. One is that the fleeing of thousands, tens of thousands of people from that area. People are concerned about the consequences of the fighting that's taking place. But there has been another aspect that has not really been touched upon by the media here, and this is the attacks that have taken place on the infrastructure, particularly on some water, on a dam, and also on some water facilities, as well as electrical facilities and stations, and that could even make life for the people in that area much more difficult and much more painful.
Our other panelists have some questions, but I had one important point I wanted to raise with you here, and that is there's been a lot of pushback among the establishment, if you want to call it that, among Democrats and Republicans against Donald Trump's move to pull back U.S. troops there. I wondered if you would help us speculate as to the motive for Donald Trump acceding to the demands of Turkish President Erdogan here in allowing, giving him the green light, in essence, to push this operation, this military operation in northern Syria. There's been a lot of talk about Trump owning two major towers in the city of Istanbul in Turkey, and that may have played into his decision here to work with Erdogan in allowing this operation to go forward. What can you tell us about the motive here of Donald Trump?
Whether or not there is Trump has a property there may be a factor, but I don't think this is really the major factor. I think on the one hand, Trump has been saying for a long time, whether he said it before when he was a candidate, he said it after he reached the White House, and he's been saying it recently in some of his rallies all over the past year. He says that there have been endless wars, that the U.S. has been involved in disastrous, endless wars that have brought a lot of consequences, negative consequences for the United States and for the people of that area. However, whenever there was a push or pressure on Trump, when he began to make some signs in withdrawing from some of these conflicts, he would change his mind. I think the main reasons behind this are, there are a number of them. One of the main ones is that the United States has found itself in a very, very difficult situation between the Turks, who are an important NATO ally, according to numerous officials. Even now, the head of NATO was visiting Turkey, and he was talking about how great an ally is to NATO. There have been, I was in a panel about a month before the appointment of a senior official dealing with the Syrian Israeli, with the Syrian Turkish conflict between the Kurds and also the Turkey. And this senior official was talking about how important Turkey is, that ultimately, if we have to make a decision, Turkey is far more important because of it has the second largest army in NATO. It's near Russia. We need Turkey to be there to confront Russia. So to be also an ally in the Middle East and the broader Middle East. I think that there is this factor in the minds, at least, of some of U.S. officials. And it appeared that there was a difference of opinion between the Central Command, which is supporting the Kurds, which operates in the Middle East and has been more sympathetic to the Kurds, and the European Command, which has been more sympathetic to the Turks. So there is that factor. But I think ultimately the U.S. found itself in a very difficult position between these two allies. And ultimately, the Turks have been saying for a long time that they were going to invade. So in a way, this should not have come as a surprise, as we have heard. More than about maybe 9 days ago, there was an article which appeared in a number of papers quoting a senior official who did not permit the use of his name, saying a major storm, a full storm, is brewing in that part of Syria, between Syria and the Kurds, and that basically this may force the United States to withdraw. Another official was quoted as saying the U.S. does not have sufficient forces to stand up to the Turks there if the Turks decide to invade. So that's another, I think, issue. This was another sign that things were not going very well. There were talks that have been going on between Turkey and the United States. The U.S. has approved a certain area allowing the Turks to move into the border strip, although there were disagreements over the depth and the width of that incursion. The Turks wanted to go somewhere between 30 to 35 kilometers. The United States was saying 5 to 7, maybe up to 10 kilometers. So basically there was sort of an agreement that was reached between the two sides a while back. However, the depth of that area is a major issue, actually, because that is going to raise questions about what are Turkey's ultimate objectives. What is Turkey also trying to do here? Are they really simply wanting to fight the Kurds? And there is that issue. There has been a war going on between Turkey and Turkish Kurds since the early 1980s. They consider the Syrian Democratic Forces, or the PYD, which are forces led by the Kurds in Syria, as part of the PKK. The PKK is the Kurdistan Workers' Party. The U.S., as well as Turkey, consider it a terrorist organization. It has been fighting against Turkey since the early 80s. The United States, however, does not recognize the Syrian Democratic Forces, or the PYD, which are the Kurdish Syrian forces, as terrorists. So basically there were differences between the United States and Turkey on this issue. So the Turks consider this issue of the PKK and the PYD as to be one party, and they see this as a threat. If the Turks in Syria are able to establish their own zone or their own entity or a self, an autonomous region, this would pose a big problem for Turkey, because if there are 2 to 2.5 million Kurds in Syria, there are somewhere between 22 to 24 million Kurds in Turkey. So then the Turks are fearful that if the Syrian Kurds are able to achieve that, what are Turkish Kurds going to do? That's one. The second reason why I think Turkey is also very much involved and interested in this, one is that Erdogan has recently been facing difficulties internally. He lost two important elections, his party did, in Istanbul and Ankara. Istanbul is about a quarter of Turkey. So these were two major losses. And part of the reason why he lost was also because Turkey has several 3 to 3.5 million Syrian refugees. There has been growing resentment against these refugees inside Turkey, and that has been also a factor. So he wants to settle those refugees back in this security zone in Turkey. And that's another issue, another objective behind Turkey, in addition to the political objectives that the Turkish president hopes to gain from this.
Professor Garib, that point that you just made, I think, is the thing that has gotten Kurds in northeastern Syria very upset, and the reason that they are migrating now in the hundreds of thousands, leaving their towns and fleeing in terror and panic. The notion that the Turks would suddenly unleash up to 3 million Syrian refugees into the region that the Kurds are now occupying. What would happen if that were to come about, if suddenly that influx of Syrian refugees were plunked down in that northeastern region where the Kurds are building what, by all measure, is a very experimental, democratic, some would say, bottom-up kind of governance, a flourishing state that is an example probably to people not just in the region but globally?
That's a very, very good question. I mean, basically, first of all, that's why the Turks wanted a much larger area. They wanted to control an area that could go as deep as 35 miles inside Syrian territory and as far as 400 kilometers, if not maybe 450, all the way to the Iraqi borders. Basically, if they are going to settle, it's very difficult to settle that large number of people in the small area that they would be able to control along the border strip. That's why they would like to bring in maybe a large number of these refugees, as high as 2 million, 2.5 million. And that is going to be very difficult because it's going to be what happened, what we saw in the earlier invasion in Afrin. This was another area in northern Syria, where to the west of the Euphrates River, where basically Turkey invaded, and the Kurds, there were about 100 to 150,000 Kurds who fled from that area. And what the Turks did is they brought Syrian refugees and Syrian allies, families of Syrian fighters against the regime who are sympathetic to Turkey, and settled them in that area. So we saw here a sort of ethnic cleansing or a humanitarian disaster in many ways, and ethnic transfer. And this could be on a much larger scale, because this part of Syria has it's a very complex and area, very diverse area in terms of its population. The Kurds are a majority in only parts of it, but there are also Arabs, there are Christian Assyrians, there are Syriac Christians also, there are some small Armenian villages, towns, where there are a number of Armenians in those also cities. So basically, it's much more complex, and that is going to be much more devastating in terms of its consequences, especially if Turkey decides, as in the past we have heard comments from some Turkish officials who speak of the neo-Ottomanism talking about bringing back some of the glories or the influence of the Ottoman Empire to the neighboring areas. And if that happens, basically, and Turkey decides to stay there, to stay in that area, this is going to be the occupation of a illegal occupation of the territory of another state. It's going to be devastating to the Kurds, to the Assyrian Christians, and to the Armenians, to the Arabs who live in that area. So this is could have devastating humanitarian consequences. But the danger also is that it might lead to an escalation of the fighting. We might see the Kurds moving to establish an alliance. There have been now attempts to create a dialogue between the Kurds and the Syrian government in Damascus, and that could also create a new conflict between the Syrian government, which considers any foreign forces on its territory without its approval as being occupying forces, and that these forces, sooner or later, Syria is going to fight to get them out. So this might accelerate that conflict between Turkey and Syria, and it also might draw in other regional players, and maybe perhaps we already saw, as you referred earlier, to the attack which came close to Syrian, to U.S. forces in northeast Syria.
Professor, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this term we've heard, Rojava, which refers to the Kurdish state in northeastern Syria. Tell us a little bit about it. What we've heard is that the supporters in that region argue that it's an officially secular polity. It has direct democratic ambitions based on libertarian socialist ideology, promoting decentralization, gender equality, environmental sustainability, and pluralistic tolerance for religions, cultures, and political diversity. This model for society may be unique on the globe, and I'm just wondering what you can say about that, including the important role that women are playing in this model, where they are taking leadership roles in organizing, in leading meetings, and also in exercising on the military front. The women are very prominent and fierce in defending the state with military means. How is this model? What else can you say about it? And how is it, in a sense, posing another level of threat to the much more authoritarian trends that exist around it?
Well, I think this is a great question, primarily because, first of all, I think to understand a little bit about that area. This is an area of Syria that has been historically occupied by people of different ethnic and religious makeups. In some areas, you have a Kurdish majority. In other areas, you have an Arab majority. In other parts of it, you had also mixed populations of Syrian Christians, whether they are Assyrians or Syriacs or Orthodox, they are living in that area. There are also Armenians who are in that part of the world. But that area is not historically a majority Kurdish area, although there were areas where the Kurds, there have been Kurdish communities. Some of the Kurds who are living in this area are Kurds who fled or were forced out of Turkey during the Kurdish uprisings that took place in Turkey between 1926, the first one was actually started in 1925, and 1938. There were a number of uprisings that took place during this time against the Turkish nationalist government of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey. As a result of this, about 1 million people were fled or were forced out from that region, which had a Kurdish majority. About hundreds of thousands of them fled to Syria. And so the Kurdish population in that part of what is being described as Rojava has Kurds who had, up until recently, in fact, were not given citizenship by the Syrian government, and only in 2011 about 250 to 300,000 were given Syrian citizenships. And then there were Syrian Kurds who had been living there for hundreds and hundreds of years. But there is also another Kurdish population in Syria and other parts of Syria. That Kurdish population is much older, but those are were in Damascus and Hama and Homs and other parts of Syria. So that is one of the first things. Secondly, what you're talking about is that this Syrian PYD, or the this is the People's Protection Units and the Syrian People's Democratic Party that was rules this area now and controls this area, leads the combined Syrian Democratic Forces, which is has also Arabs, has some Christians fighting with the along their side. It is ideologically, actually, as you pointed out, was influenced by the ideas of the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, which was originally a Marxist leftist organization. They are secular generally. They have given recognized the rights of women. They have the leaders, in fact, of this group is a woman. You have women, as you pointed out, women fighters. So basically, there's this equality that is being pushed, and this is different. Even it's different. The Kurds in Syria are different, even in this aspect, from the Kurds of Iraq or Iran. So this is a significant change. So what the Kurds have seen is that they had hoped that the U.S. this time would support them, since they played a major role in fighting against ISIS, and they want to establish, they have not claimed that they want to establish an independent entity and or an independent Kurdish state. They have talked about preserving their own culture, their own language, and also they wanted to have an autonomous region or a federal within a federal system in Syria. So basically, they have not called for independence as such. And so as a result of this, we see a very complicated situation where sometimes they're saying, and they're reaching out to the Syrian government, at other times trying to maintain control and deny the government control of the oil fields, of the rich agricultural land in that part of the area. And that's been part of the conflict between them and Damascus as well, because while they both oppose ISIS, at the same time they disagree on what kind of a role and what kind of an institutions are we likely to see in that part of Syria, northeast Syria, which is also known as Rojava, and that has been a serious issue between the two sides. They both are. It seems now there are efforts to get the Russians involved. The Kurds have been saying they want to talk to Russia to see if it could begin a dialogue between them and Damascus. Damascus is saying that they have to hand control of the area to them, and that they should join, the Kurdish forces should join the Syrian government forces. And there, so far, there's been still some difficulties, but a lot of things could change any day, from day to day, depending on what's happening on the ground in that area.
Well, Professor Gharib, thank you so much for joining us. There's so much more we can and will talk about in the future, but we're very happy you could provide some context for understanding this Turkish invasion of this Kurdish region in northern Syria, and I hope we can call upon you again.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's Edmund Gharib. He's an internationally recognized scholar on the Kurds and on Iraq. He teaches at American University. His books include The Kurdish Nationalist Movement and The Kurdish Question in Iraq. I'll turn it over to you guys while we get our other guests on the line.
I was thinking about Donald Trump, who seems to consider foreign affairs more a matter of playing with your little men. I had a neighbor when I was a kid who had thousands of little toy soldiers, and his favorite thing to do on a rainy day especially was to deploy them all on his porch and have battles with them. And Trump seems to have that kind of notion about any aspect of military or geopolitical engagement. And listening to Professor Gharib, I thought, I don't think that Donald Trump's mind is the mind to attempt to encounter this very complex situation and a complex part of the world.
Well, Ruthanne, I was watching All In with Chris Hayes last night, and they had a segment with Richard Engel, who's a Middle Eastern correspondent and a pretty good journalist. And he was giving forth with a lot of those last night. And just to read a couple of things he said, the Kurds believe that this is going to be a long-term campaign and that the Turks want to settle this area. That's the northeastern Syria area. That they will soon face a campaign of genocide and ethnic cleansing that Trump gave the green light to. Mm-hmm. The context is that there are 2 million Kurds in northeastern Syria under American protection, and these Kurds have created a little state that has been unusually successful, one of the most stable places in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Towns like Kobani are opening up and they're flourishing. And just across the border in Turkey, there are 12 million Kurds who for a long time in Turkey have been complaining that they are treated as second-class citizens. And there have been uprisings staged by those Kurds in Turkey. Turkey has been very concerned that if there is a successful Kurdish enclave, the Rojava that we've referred to here in northeastern Syria, it will inspire the 12 million Kurds inside Turkey to rise up. And it's not just that they are attacking this enclave to destroy it. Turkey has a plan to move Arab refugees, the Syrians who fled the Syrian war, from inside Turkey and settle them within the enclave in northeastern Syria. That would be 1 to 3 million people displacing the Kurds. And this is why the Kurds are panicked. And they say they are fighting not just against the Turks, they're fighting for their own existence. And they say that Donald Trump, with his order, has opened the door to possible ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. And that's why over 100,000 people, 100,000 of them are already on the move. Now, Erdogan, a couple of days ago, was braying from his platform, literally just taunting the European Union, saying that the European Union, if you keep criticizing me for my incursion into northeastern Syria, then I'm going to take these Syrian refugees, these 1 to 3 million of them, and send them back to Europe.
Yeah.
You know, so he's basically putting it out there that it's either you take them or I'm going to put them back in northeastern Syria, and that's my plan. So everything Richard Engel said last night with some very good reporting, Chris Hayes on MSNBC, seems to be borne out by the facts on the ground. Well, we do have, most grateful that we have two very important spokespersons on the issues that we're going to talk about tonight, which is basically the Trump impeachment saga, which was triggered most recently by his attempt to strong-arm the president of Ukraine into digging up dirt on the Bidens. But with us, we have the national correspondent for The Nation magazine, John Nichols. John, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
It's always a delight to have you here. And we also have...
Yeah, Lisa Gilbert is here, the Vice President for Legislative Affairs from Public Citizen. She's on the line with us as well. Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have the basis for a very dynamic conversation here on this topic of impeachment. First of all, maybe we could just put out the question, will Donald Trump be impeached on the one hand? Will he resign before impeachment is actually even implemented in the House of Representatives? But what is the basic prognosis as you see it right now with just a couple of months remaining in 2019? John, why don't you take a shot at that?
Sure, I'll be glad to. He'll be impeached. I expect it will come relatively soon. All indications are that the process is moving quickly. Trump is obviously trying not to go along with it, but those who are impeached always do that. Sometimes more aggressively, sometimes less. In many ways, what Trump is doing now, refusing to cooperate, calling it a coup, things like that, hastens the process. It doesn't slow it down. My sense is that it's very possible that you could have articles of impeachment around the start of November and potentially even have a House vote sometime during November, probably before Thanksgiving. And so that gets any answer to your first question. Now, could that get tripped up? Of course it could. But, you know, my sense is that if you know anything about Nancy Pelosi, she's not the sort of person who launches an inquiry without having the votes counted, so to speak. And so I think you're pretty much there. The only thing that they'll work on now is to try and get a little bit of Republican buy-in for it. That'll be very, very hard. They'll have Justin Amash, the independent, voting with him or with them. They might get one of the retiring Republicans, somebody like a Will Hurd, but even that is not certain. Then the question is, what does Trump do about it? Will he resign? I'm very dubious about that notion. I think that it's not just Trump himself who's a combative figure. It's also that among a lot of folks who are historians of impeachment, there's a sense that if Nixon hadn't resigned, he might well have survived in a Senate vote. That's a debatable point. I'm not necessarily in that camp. But certainly there'll be people who will counsel Trump not to resign, and it won't be his inclination. So it will go to the Senate. There'll be a Senate trial. At this point, the logical bet is that the Republican majority in the Senate will acquit him. And frankly, that's fine. I mean, it's not something I want. I think he should be impeached and that he should be convicted. But the important thing to understand, if you have any historical perspective on impeachment, is that it is the act of impeachment that is powerful. No president has ever been convicted and removed by the Senate. But when you are impeached, it does go on your record. And in this case, we enter a fascinating new stage, which, if Trump does pursue his reelection campaign, as all indications are, he'll be the first president in history to run for reelection having been impeached. And from any historical standpoint, that is a fascinating new place to enter into, but one which I think would be a tremendous burden for him politically. So that's my sense of where we're at right now.
Well, let me put this to Lisa. We have a widening circle of administration officials who seem to be involved in this Ukraine scandal, this extortion scandal, including William Barr, the Attorney General, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, President's erstwhile personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. And we're seeing more and more officials who've been involved in this thing. Do you have any sense as to the kind of upheaval that could occur in this administration because of possible convictions for the involvement in this extortion scandal?
It's a great question, and certainly the evidence is so overwhelming in this case that we're expecting there to be more and more fallout amongst administration officials and also most likely more whistleblowers coming forward. That's usually how that works. When one person has the courage to speak, others gain it and do so too. You know, the evidence just mounts. We have the call transcript. We have the whistleblower report. We have the State Department text messages, and now we have all these witnesses who are coming into House Intelligence and speaking, and also the convictions that you mentioned. So it does seem like an ever-escalating tale. I think our job, and certainly the job of the House Democrats, is to keep folks focused on the core crime and the fact that Trump has already admitted in his own words that he extorted, he asked for a favor in the phone call. And so a large part of how this plays out from here is going to be about whether the public understands that, how narrow we can keep the message. And then I completely agree with John's assessment of the timeline and the hurdles and things like pulling Republicans to support the inquiry and support impeachment too, as well as what eventually happens in the Senate and how Trump reacts, all depend on whether the public comes along and people understand the true guilt that we already know, that we already have the goods. And so we need to proceed in that vein through the impeachment process.
We've seen a complete stonewalling from the Trump administration, not just during this current phase, this acute phase that we're in since the Ukrainian revelations. But right along, since the Democrats have started to investigate, fallout from the Mueller report and other things, they've called witnesses, they've been stonewalled. What do you make of that? I mean, I can't imagine that Americans are looking at this and thinking that our federal government, our federal system, our democratic system, has any currency anymore. That when it comes down to it, one man with his minions and his lieutenants can simply just say no and game over. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll take a grab at this. Not necessarily game over. This is where it gets really interesting. Look, our constitutional system has always been strikingly vulnerable. We have lived in a fantasy that suggests that, we've got all this sort of structure and stability. In fact, the Constitution is a very vague document. It either lives or dies based on the people who are in power, who animate it, who make it work, or who undermine it. In this case, what Donald Trump has done, and I've said this from the start of his presidency, Donald Trump exposes our vulnerabilities. He exposed the vulnerability in our election system on many levels, but the ultimate vulnerability that is we have an electoral college that allows the loser of the popular vote to become president. Since he's become president, he's exposed the vulnerability of the cabinet system, where the president gets elected, and if he's got a Senate, he could put just about anybody in the cabinet, no matter how incompetent, no matter how crooked. And now he is exposing the vulnerability of the system of checks and balances. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because up to that point, he had overwhelming advantages that, whether we liked it or not, he could make Betsy DeVos Secretary of Education. In this case, though, as the system of checks and balances is kind of put to its test, the House of Representatives has a tremendous number of options. They just haven't been used a lot. Impeachment itself is a check and balance. And if used and used in the right way, and I really agree with what was said just a moment ago, I mean, it's how well you do it. We have the goods, as was said. Now the question is, do you present them in a way that's very convincing to the American people? If you do, there is a chance, not a certainty, that some Republicans move. So then you start to have a bipartisan impeachment. It may or may not knock Trump out of office, but at the very least, it has a great currency with the American people. But there's one other thing as regards these other officials, which I think is a big deal, and I really recommend keeping an eye on what one of the smartest people in Congress, Congressman Mark Pocan, the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, is doing. Last week, when Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, basically ordered people not to testify in Congress, put a block on it. Pocan, who's a real legislative specialist, dusted off a bill, dusted off a law that's on the books, and pulled out some precedent that says that the Congress, can refuse to pay, or try at least to refuse to pay, those officials who are not cooperating with Congress. And this is where you start to up the ante of checks and balances. And I would just say it's a big deal. We are now in a testing moment. Will we pass the test? I don't know. But I really respect your question. I think your question opens up what can either be a very dark scenario, i.e. that our system really is so fundamentally flawed that it could get into a very bad place. But it also opens up a positive scenario that this could be the moment at which a system of checks and balances really is reasserted. And that may have consequences far beyond the impeachment of Donald Trump. And I certainly hope it does.
I've been listening to Trump's rhetoric at his I try not to listen to it, but I have been hearing his rhetoric at his so-called rallies. And he, far from sustaining or supporting the idea of the rule of law. And I love the use of the laws that most of us have never heard of and suddenly coming in to to their power. But he's using language that is really, I think, dangerous. I may be overestimating the people who do the yelling and the waving of their AK-47s, but when he talks about the Democrats trying to stage a coup and promising that if he's impeached, there will be civil war, how much resonance do you think that that degree of language is having on, not me, but members of the public who are so inclined? Do you think there's any follow-through on that? Do you think it's risky for him to be talking that way?
So I don't think it is a winning message to anyone but the people who are already persuaded that he is above the law. Certainly when we, you know, we've seen polling trending in direction of support of the impeachment, and the reason for that is that people do see this particular situation as slightly distinct from the overwhelming corruption that we've seen throughout his administration. You know, they see a clear quid pro quo. They see him asking for assistance, and it's something that if they did anything like that, you know, they would go to jail. And that resonates with people in a different way than, unfortunately, the sort of 2 years of drip-drip revelations of the Mueller report. And so now I think we're in a different space with persuadables and independents and hopefully even some moderate Republicans. And I don't think that the message of, you know, Trump inciting hate in reaction to this is going to play well with those folks.
I just had a question if I could ask here, and that would be, we've seen a recent Fox poll surprisingly showing 51% of those who were surveyed said not only did they back impeachment, but they also backed Trump's removal from office. This is Fox News, so it was kind of surprising. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering here, as things heat up and the obstruction continues from the Trump regime, what is the role of the public? I mean, we've seen the example of protesters in Hong Kong where people have tied up the streets for 4 months and made that city ungovernable. What is the role of the public here? I mean, if the stonewalling continues and the obstruction continues, citizen action, direct action, nonviolent civil disobedience, is that part of this impeachment process, in your view? And I could ask you both to comment on that. Lisa, would you go first?
Sure. I think the role of the public is essential in every piece of this process from here on out. I think the House is proceeding in a deliberate and quick manner, and what will matter to the next step, which is what happens in the Senate, is all about how the public reacts to what they see in the House, and how they act as well. So, you know, certainly there is a role for people to be in the streets, particularly pressuring senators who are the judge and jury in this situation. They will be responding to the case that the House presents, and they need to feel that their constituents expect them to take the evidence for what it is and act. There's a gravity to impeachment that I do think the senators are taking seriously and trying to grapple with it. And I wouldn't say it's a foregone conclusion that Republican senators will be able to resist that responsibility. But certainly, whether they can or not is dependent on how active the public is, whether they think their base cares, and how it's presented to them.
Here's the counsel I would give. In the way that Scott asked the question, it suggests a little bit of you know, the situation where the public is often in a disempowered place, right? And so you do go to demonstrations, even nonviolent civil disobedience protests. And I think that, as Lisa suggests, that's all a part of it. I would suggest just one thing. The public should feel empowered in this. The public, a great mass of people, should feel happy and excited in what they are doing. And I know those are words rarely associated with this process because it's often portrayed as a constitutional crisis and something scary and all this stuff. No, this is a reassertion of basic constitutional premises. And so I think the only suggestion I would make is that, yes, there's a huge public component in it. We're already seeing the power of the public component simply in the polling. The fact that the polls are showing there's a lot of support for this definitely strengthens the will, I think, of a lot of Democratic members and makes some Republican members in the House and Senate think a little differently. But as we move to protests, my sense is that instead of feeling, you know, wow, you know, we're up against this horrible thing, the great strength of this moment is to step forward and say, no, this is how it is supposed to work. You have a president who did take office after an election. So you don't undo elections casually. You treat them with respect. But you also understand that this president lost the popular vote by almost 3 million votes and has abused his office horribly. And so it's absolutely appropriate to be holding him to account. And the argument ought to be put in that way rather than in, you know, please do something. You know, this is an emergency. This is a crisis. No, it is not a crisis. Impeachment is the cure for a constitutional crisis, and it ought to be applied. And people should be very confident, very, I would again argue, optimistic in asserting that position, especially when they talk to Republican senators. They shouldn't blink on it. And my sense is that if they do it in that way, nothing disempowers Trump more than that.
John, thank you for that. I think that there's a tendency for us to be the little birds in the nest receiving the little treats from our mom, the media. And when the polling results come out that show that 51% of the population not only wants the impeachment process to continue, but for Trump to be removed, we say, oh, okay, fantastic, we did our job. But I think that that it's got to be supplemented by people in the streets, not allowing the media to completely dominate the process here and to receive the gifts that they give and sometimes the bad news that they bring. We have to be there backing up our beliefs in this situation and being a parallel track to whatever data the media are dispensing. The media is very fickle on this. The polling data tend to be very unreliable, tend to be all over the map. So I think that the bulwark and the immutable is people in the streets. And this is a great time for us to be doing that. It's a great day to resist. Let's get out there and do it. The weather's good. Let's enjoy it.
We've been speaking this morning here with John Nichols, the Nation magazine's national affairs correspondent, also author of The Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. Also, the book The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. Also on the line has been Lisa Gilbert, Vice President for Legislative Affairs with Public Citizen. Thank you both for joining us. It's been great to get your perspective on this impeachment crisis as it moves forward, and the role of the public, as we discussed a moment ago. Thank you both. We'll look forward to talking again soon.
John, be with you. It's an honor to be out, Lisa.
Bye-bye, Lisa. Thanks. Bye, John.
And you've been listening to the Resistance Roundtable. We're coming down the very last minute of our show. Waiting to hear a little theme music. Ah, there we go. That allows me, lubricates me so I can blather on here for a moment. But thanks for listening to the Resistance Roundtable, which comes to you the second Saturday of each month. Thanks for Scott Harris, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, myself, Richard Hill. We'll be back second Saturday of November. And stay tuned to WPKN for more great programming. Barricada is up next.